Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by going to Italy, where overwhelmed doctors are calling for another lockdown. Italy was the first country in Europe to be hit by the pandemic and has lost just under 43,000 lives, the highest death toll on the continent. Almost 30,000 people are hospitalized, the highest number since the start of the pandemic. Newsweek reports that in Naples, Italy's third largest city, COVID patients are receiving oxygen in their cars because hospitals are so overwhelmed. Joining us with the latest is Eric Regoli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. And Eric joins us from Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back, Eric. It's been a while since we spoke with you. How are you and your friends and colleagues and your family doing?
Well, to be honest, first off, I'm healthy. I've had two COVID tests, so that's good news. The bad news is my morale is sinking fast. We don't have a national lockdown in Italy, but it looks like we're going to be there probably within a matter of days because the cases are out of control in this country. And morale's sinking. I mean, we were all thinking, could we face another month or two in tight lockdown in small Roman apartments, and it's miserable, and it's making me angry too, because Italy had it beat in the summer and then they totally messed it up.
Well, tell us what happened, because the United States is also surging, possibly for different reasons, but it would be interesting to learn more.
Okay, so Italy, as you said, Rose, was first into lockdown, had the longest, tightest lockdown in the world. It went until about mid-May. And then at that point, the cases had dropped down to low double digits. These are the new daily cases and the deaths. And what Italy had done was remarkable. It had largely eradicated community transmission because of this tight lockdown. So what it did was, without saying it, they declared victory and partied. And that's the problem. So the people went back to the beaches, the borders were opened, but the main, and mask use got sloppy, physical distancing got sloppy. But in my view, the main problem was Italy did not invest heavily in rapid COVID tests. Mm. It should have been ubiquitous, should have been everywhere. They had the technology and they didn't deploy it. Like, people were coming back from Sardinia, which was a COVID hotspot in August because of all the nightclubs, and they weren't being tested at the ports or the airports. And it just went like wildfire fire through the whole country.
Wow. It just proves that this virus really can spread so fast. I mean, we're seeing the same thing in many parts of the United States. And I hear you when you're talking about morale, because those of us who are really taking this seriously are staying in, if we can, as much as possible. And it's becoming very tiring, especially when you can't see your family.
Yeah, it's we're just sick of this. I mean, this is going on, God, you know, 9-10 months now. And even in, you know, the people who were careful in the summer, like me, my family, even though the country was largely liberated in the summer, you know, a lot of us were very, very careful. And we didn't go to restaurants at nights. If we had a cafe, we made sure we were on the street drinking it there, not actually going inside the cafe. We didn't travel outside the country, and we didn't go to regions of Italy where the cases were relatively high. So, and we just, you know, I would say most of us were careful in Italy, but there were, you know, obviously a few million of the 60 million in this country who were not, and we're paying for that sloppiness. But the government also was terrible on communications. They should have said, look, it's coming down. Let's not spoil this victory. These are the rules that stay in place. I mean, strict social distancing. And they should have put in mask use as well, mandatory mask use outside the house for for everything, absolutely everything, did not come in till about 3 weeks ago.
We feel you, Eric, because you know what's going on here in the U.S. Can you tell us what you're hearing from public health officials? How is your healthcare system dealing with all of this?
Until about, I'd say about week 10 days ago, it was okay. Now, there is an interesting change from the spring pandemic wave. In Italy, the pandemic was largely isolated in the spring to northern Italy, so the area around Milan, which is the commercial and financial capital. The rest of Italy pretty much got spared. And why was that a good thing? Because in southern Italy, known as the, excuse me, the Mezzogiorno, the healthcare system is terrible. The government, no government in the last 30 years invested in the south. Luckily, the pandemic did not travel much south of Rome, and the hospitals did not get overwhelmed. So the big difference this time is that this pandemic is in every city, every village, every region, and the south is getting hammered, absolutely hammered. You mentioned Naples. You have people getting oxygen in ambulances. You have people sleeping in ambulances. Yesterday, a video went viral. It was a patient in a Naples hospital. I forget the name of the hospital. He was videotaped. He went into the washroom. He died on the floor. Oh. And, you know, and it just went across the country and shocked everyone. Mm. And this is what's happening in southern Italy. The northern Italy is barely coping now. In Piedmont, which is Turin, very wealthy part of the country. It's where Fiat is based, where they had the Olympics in 2006. They are so overwhelmed there that they're hiring doctors and nurses from China. Now the problem is, I mean, some doctors are dying. 188 doctors have died in Italy since the start of the pandemic, but 16,000, get this, 16,000 medics have been infected. So as soon as they get infected, they're out of the game. They're put into isolation and they can't work. So there's not enough medics to handle the ICU wards or to do the ventilators. They're just not around.
Wow. That, you know, Eric, this reminds me of a piece I read yesterday in NBC about what's happening in North Dakota. Because they have such a shortage of healthcare workers, they're asking COVID positive healthcare workers to stay on the job. The nurses are saying this is so irresponsible because these positive COVID healthcare workers have to take elevators. They use bathrooms. There's no way you can contain the virus. I mean, it's shocking to read that, you know, in the US, they're asking COVID positive health nurses to stay on the job.
Yeah, but in Italy too, we saw reports in a couple of hospitals in northern Italy. Some of the COVID positive doctors were asked to stay on the job in the ICU wards where most people are COVID positive anyway. Not a good situation. They're trying to, they're accelerating the graduation of medical students. They're importing doctors. In the spring, there were emergency tent hospitals, like military hospitals, put up in parking lots. That's coming back. You're seeing that. But, you know, the regional lockdowns are coming. And if they do, if these regional lockdowns, about half the country is in lockdown now. There's 20 regions, about 12 or 13 are in pretty tight lockdown. So the curve should start flattening, you know, probably within the next week to 10 days, as it has in France, as it has in Spain, as it has in Ireland. In those countries, you look at those countries, the number of cases per 100,000 on a rolling 7-day average, they're starting to dip quite dramatically now, just in the last few days.
You mentioned your healthcare workers. Can you just remind us, Eric, what are the main differences between Italy's healthcare system and the system in the United States?
Well, the Italian system is like the Canadian system. I'm Canadian. So there's there's really no such thing as a national healthcare system, neither in Canada or in Italy. There is a national health authority that funds the regions, that sets, you know, basic rules for the regions, but it's up to the individual regions to run and fund their own healthcare systems, as there is in Canada. Like in British Columbia, it's not a Canada system in Canada. You have a British Columbia healthcare system, Ontario, Quebec, et cetera. So that's how it works. Generally, from Rome north, the healthcare system in Italy is very, very good. In the south, it's a disaster.
Well, today we're speaking with Eric Reguli, who's the European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, and we're getting an update on what's happening with the COVID surge in Italy. And if you have any questions for Eric, he'll be with us for about 15 more minutes. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, the last time we had you on, we talked about how just incredibly difficult this has been for people, for small businesses, for those, you know, when people travel to Italy, of course, what people love is that the small feel of the shops and the beauty. And you talked about how hard that's been for people. What has it been like now that we're in, mid-November? How are people doing?
Well, the restaurants, bars, cafes reopened in the summer with restrictions. They could only go at half capacity inside. So the restaurants and cafes and bars moved everyone out into the street, and they changed the bylaws very quickly to allow that, which was great. I mean, the Rome where I live felt very lively, but about, I would say anecdotally, 20 to 30 restaurants and bars did not reopen. They just didn't have the financial capacity to go through a 2 or 3 month lockdown. Now this sector is failing again, because even though in the areas that are not locked down, including Rome, there is a curfew of, not a curfew, bars have to be closed and restaurants by 6 p.m. And there is a 10 p.m. curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 p.m. Most bars, restaurants make their money in the evening. And Italians, as you know, they eat late. You don't even think about eating until 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So they're going through another crisis now. And I think a lot are not going to make it. And it's heartbreaking. And the other thing that's heartbreaking, Rose, is Amazon. Italy has the highest percentage in Europe of small and medium-sized businesses. Most of them are family-controlled. I mean, some of them are global leaders. The manufacturers, but most of them are small and medium-sized businesses. And Amazon is now taking over now. So even if what's happening is Italians for the first time are getting used to home delivery. And that was never the case, you know, even last year. I mean, Amazon was sort of it was out there, but it was a bit of an app. You know, no one really understood it. I mean, people like going out. And I'm worried now that a lot of these small shops, you know, the food shops and that, the retailers, the clothing shops, are going to die now that Italians are getting used to Amazon.
Wow. So the question is, once we get through this, will that continue? Will people get so used to it that they'll continue using Amazon?
Yeah, I think so. Look, we're guilty ourselves. Because we're being very careful in our household, we're getting most of our food delivered from home delivery. I have used Amazon myself, but as soon as it's safe to go shopping again, I mean, I'm going to stop using it. I've vowed to do that because I don't want Amazon and other delivery giants ripping through the social fabric of this country. I mean, what people come to Italy for is, other than the history and the architecture, is the really vibrant street life, the small shops. I mean, when I moved to Italy a decade ago, there was almost no chain stores in Italy. I mean, there are a few now, but it's still pretty low by by North American or European standards. Yes, we have a Gap here. Yes, we have McDonald's, but it's not like London, which is, you know, one huge chain store. And that's going to change here because the chain stores can thrive in this economy.
Wow. Well, that I took a trip in October 2019, and it's so true, Eric. Just sitting in a cafe for hours is just an amazing experience, watching people go by, looking at the amazing architecture. And it's just so sad to hear that some of those places could possibly close.
Well, they are closing. Absolutely. It's not possible. It's not theoretical. Mm-hmm. It's happening. And I don't know. So if 20% are closed now, you know, it's I'm making this up, but I could see another 20% not opening again. They just don't have the financial stamina to keep going. Every third store has got a
percent. Has the government done anything in terms of unemployment? Any kind of benefits?
Well, yeah. They have what they call furlough schemes here. I mean, they're slow to come, and the government's running out of money. You know, I mean, Italy was in terrible financial shape even before the pandemic. But they're going to do another round. I mean, the big change this week, as you know, was Pfizer announcing this vaccine. So if Italy is and the EU have contract, European Union has a contract for 300 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine. Mm-hmm. It'll come in force next year. So we can see the end of the pandemic suddenly, you know, as of this week. When is it going to end? Who knows? Maybe this time next year we could say, I mean, I don't think the virus is ever going to be eradicated, but we can probably see the mass pandemic coming to an end. So now the government is going to be doubly motivated in Italy and elsewhere in Europe to keep these businesses alive until the vaccine comes. If this vaccine doesn't come or hadn't come, the government might have said, look, you know, we're just going to have to let you guys go and have this total, because there's no end. There's going to be no end for this pandemic.
Mm. We have an email from Sharon who says, why in the North, why is the average personal income so much higher than the South? And can you also explain the divide in healthcare quality?
Oh, that's a good question. The North is very much tied into the European economy. So Northern Italy is productive. The supply lines go into Austria, Germany, France, Switzerland. So that part of the world is very productive and very, very competitive. So they invest a lot in Northern Italy. So the incomes are much higher. The hospitals are better. The standard of living is better. The South has been abandoned. Now, I'm not supposed to say this, but one of the reasons the South has received very little investment is also because of mafia, of the mafia's power down there. So like foreign companies don't want to build factories in the South because there's a lot of mafia there. Also, it's just far from the markets. I mean, Italy is very long and skinny, right? So why build a factory in Sicily if the factory is going to supply products to Germany? It just doesn't make any sense.
We have a caller. Let's go to Christine in Berkeley. Hi, Christine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm familiar with the society in Italy and how, you know, some of the attitudes are, and I'm wondering how the attitudes towards masks are, if there are stigmas against using masks. And I'm also wondering what the government is doing for people who, you know, for small businesses, for the economic recovery. I think I have a lot more questions, but I think I'll leave it at two. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, Christine. Masks. Yes. Good question. Unlike United States, mask use here is, I would say, 100%. There was very little resistance to masks. You can get them cheaply. They're about 50 cents a piece. They were hard to get at first because production had to ramp up. The problem was the government did not make them absolutely mandatory for all outdoor use until a few weeks ago, though they were mandatory for shop going to supermarkets, for example. So there are very effective tools. I mean, there's only two really effective tools absent a virus. One is a mask. One is mask use, and the other is lockdowns and physical distancing. I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of the question.
Is the government helping people who are out of work and helping small business owners?
Yes, they are. They're paying a high percentage of their salaries. Though some of my friends who operate cafes near me complain that the money is not coming fast enough, and it's way behind in coming. And one of the because it's this money is there but late, some of these small businesses are not making it.
Well, thank you for the call, Christine. Carolyn writes in, this program just highlights how irresponsible the public is. I even find my own adult daughters entering my home maskless, and when masked, they wear an ill-fitting mask. She writes, people just don't get it, how serious COVID really is.
Yeah, if some of the younger, the teenagers, sometimes you don't see them without masks, but you get heavily fined now, so it's rare. And I think, again, what's the difference between the pandemic now and in the spring, Rose, is that younger people in Italy and throughout Europe are getting infected now. And that's scaring some of the young people. I would say that by and large, Italians of any age are being quite responsible now, but it's too late. They should have been, 100% responsible in June, July, and August when they had it beat.
Right. Well, Eric, before we let you go, I just would love to hear your thoughts about the U.S. election. How are people in Europe responding? First, let's talk about the facts that Joe Biden has been declared the winner. He actually was declared the winner of Arizona yesterday, which gives him 290 electoral votes. How are people responding to that?
They're astonished by it. United States to Europeans and general Italians has been, the model democracy, a beacon of hope. And how can United States now or Donald Trump criticize other countries for, rigged elections, for rigged cheating when he's doing it himself? It's huge disappointment. There's huge relief that Joe Biden won. Italy, including the Pope, has congratulated Biden. Though having said that, if I just finish on this, Trump was not popular in Italy, but he was more popular in Italy than some other countries in Europe. I mean, he had 15% of Italians really liked him, as opposed to, essentially zero in Germany and France. So he did have some support here, mostly from the right, the anti-immigrant right wing.
Right. And how are people responding to this utter chaos that we're seeing? I mean, even this morning, his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, said they're moving forward under the assumption that there will be a second Trump term.
Well, it's just astonishment. But at the same time, I think the Italians and Europeans realize that it is game over for Trump. And, Italians especially are very suspicious. It's all intrigue here. And so they're wondering what is Trump's real game? Is he trying to load his pockets? Is he going to resign and let Pence become the president? And then Pence would pardon him at the last minute before January 20th. I mean, there's all sorts of conspiracy theories here because this is, these are old societies full of conspiracy theories. So that's what some Italians think.
Well, we'll find out. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to hear your voice, and we'll be thinking about you, your family, and your colleagues in Italy. Eric Regulli is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Thank you, Eric.
Ciao, Rose. Anytime. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, coming up after a quick break, we'll continue on this. Really, what is Trump's endgame here? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Last night, Joe Biden was declared the winner in Arizona, which gives him 290 electoral votes to Donald Trump's 217. Still, Trump refuses to concede. This morning on Fox Business, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro said, quote, "We're moving forward here under the assumption that there will be a second Trump term." So what is going on here? Joining us to talk about this is Scott Horton, legal and national security affairs writer for Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter, co-founder of DCReport.org, and author of many books, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Rose, for having me again.
Well, David, I want to start off with you. What the heck is going on here? Navarro just this morning saying that they're moving forward under the assumption there will be a second Trump term?
Well, this is what happens when you have a cult and where high government officials, including many of the leaders of the Republican Party, choose to become moral jellyfish, blind, spineless, and happy to be adrift in the chaos created by Trump. Donald Trump personally is unable to see himself as not winning a second term. And I warned about this 4 years ago, that the Trump administration would end badly. Exactly how it would end, I didn't know, but I said it will end, and it will end badly. And this is what we're seeing. The utter contempt for democracy, the utter lack of understanding of our Constitution, and Donald Trump's belief that he should run not just America, but the whole world, because after all, he's the world's greatest expert on 23 subjects. And the rest of us, unless you support him, you're idiots.
Well, David, I mean, what is his end game here? Because you now even have longtime Republican election officials who are so offended by all of this, saying we ran a clean and fair election. Let's stop with these lawsuits. I mean, these are Republicans.
But Donald creates his own reality. If he says it, that makes it so. And even if you have a videotape showing he said the exact opposite 2 minutes ago or 2 months ago or 2 years ago, he never said that. It's just that's fake news. And this has been the Donald I've known for more than 30 years. He just makes it up. And there is no end game here. Donald is not a strategic thinker. What's going on in his own mind is he grew up in this horrible, horrible household with a monster of a father who was all mobbed up and only cared about money, and a very cold, distant, unsupportive, unloving mother. And the only thing he was rewarded for was winning, which to Fred Trump meant you got the money. Whether you lied, you cheated, or you stole was irrelevant. You got the money, and now it's the power. And there's no capacity in Donald Trump to understand this. What's troubling, and we ran a piece by Dr. Bandy Lee, the Yale psychiatrist, about this at DC Report, is how many millions of Americans buy into this. It's as if they never went to junior high school. They never learned the basics of our Constitution. And they are embracing this man who is just monstrous himself in his disrespect for our institutions, for basic decency, because they are so angry about what's happened to them in America, particularly those who support him for economic reasons. And let me just point out that I just recently wrote a column showing that under Trump, incomes fell from when Obama was in office for all but the rich, and that the bottom 90% of Americans in 2018, the most recent year we have data for, made 4% less money than 45 years earlier. That means they only got 50 weeks income in 2018 for the income they got in 1973.
Wow. Well, David, to your point, Trump got, so far we've got 72 million votes. And we'll go deeper into what you just brought up because I think it's so important. But first, Scott Horton, what are your thoughts on all this? How do you explain what's going on here?
Well, I think David is right, but I think there are a few more points probably that need to be made here. One of them is that Trump does seem to have formulated with some of his inner circle over a period of several months a scheme to win, notwithstanding a loss. So I think he anticipated that he was going to come up on the short end of the election with the votes. And he looked for alternative ways to win legally and formally, even with a loss. And I think Bart Gellman did a piece in The Atlantic that laid this out. And this scheme was basically he would rely on the Republican, the strong Republican position controlling state legislatures, particularly in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona. And under the Constitution, when the vote is tallied, the Secretary of State or appropriate election officials certifies the result and transmits it to the state legislature. And the legislature then confirms the result and transmits on to the United States Senate the list of electors who will be appointed and who will cast their votes. And so his recommendation was that the legislatures make a determination that there was a fraud or some problem with the vote, and either he was cheated of the vote or it's impossible to determine who actually won, and therefore the legislature should cast out the elected set of electors and substitute for that list its own set of Republican electors, and that group would then go and cast their votes for Trump. And either would elect him or there would be such confusion in the Electoral College that the election would be thrown to the House of Representatives voting by states, in which case the Republicans would have a majority. So that's the scheme that was cooked up. And I think there's been, you can see in some of the headlines, some elements of it being played out in places like Georgia and Pennsylvania. And, you know, I've heard from reporters who've looked into it where they've gotten some Republican legislators to say, yeah, they know that this game is afoot. However, it appears that they've got cold feet, the Republican legislators do, that they see the margins by which Trump has lost are just too large to try mm-hmm. and pull off a stunt like this. So it seems that that whole scheme has also fallen apart. But that really would explain many of the pieces of what's going on now.
Okay, because we do have a few emails from listeners who are concerned about that the Electoral College seems to be a place where Republicans can call the shots. Julia writes, is that true?
And under the Constitution, that's absolutely correct. The legislatures control it formally. And you really would come down to a question of, you know, what would the court say? I mean, if they seize this power and tried to act on it, would the courts give them the right to it? And this is, I think, one reason why some of the recent decisions in the United States Supreme Court are particularly troubling, because these decisions, which they actually seem to support divergent rules on voting, vote tabulation, and extension of voting times and so forth. But the one area in which they're all consistent is they say all power rests with the legislature. It's the legislature's decision what to do, and whatever decision the legislature takes must be respected. So, you know, it looks like the Supreme Court might very well allow such a scheme to stand up were it to take off. The problem I think they have is the public outrage, the public blowback against such a scheme would be enormous, and particularly enormous in a case where they're not able to make a case, a serious case that there's been some fraud, and in case where the majority achieved by Biden is really a significant or substantial majority, which is certainly the case now in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, if you'd like to join us with Scott Horton and David K. Johnston, the number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about what's happening with the string of firings at the Pentagon. It began with the ouster of Defense Secretary Mark Esper on Monday. On Tuesday, Trump removed other key Pentagon officials, plural, including the head of intelligence and the leader of the policy apparatus. The White House then installed loyalists in top posts. According to reports, these people are expected to ram through Trump's agenda in the next couple of months. And there's some speculation about what that might mean. But David, what do you make of what's happening at the Pentagon? And what is the bigger message here?
Well, first of all, what you're seeing is a purge. And anybody in the audience who is old enough to remember the Soviet Union will understand a purge. To those who are younger, it's, you know, getting rid of anybody who isn't an absolute loyalist. And the reason you do that is because you're up to no good. My expectation is that there will be efforts to destroy records left and right, which I've warned about since he won the Electoral College 4 years ago. And we know that Trump has, in fact, destroyed a variety of records already. That there will be efforts to perhaps promote some kind of trouble in the world in an effort to bolster Trump's position. You're already seeing things happen like Secretary of State Pompeo saying that Taiwan is not part of China. The U.S. has always taken the position, at least for most 40 some years now, that the future of Taiwan and Taipei and Beijing is up to the Chinese people. And that we have an obligation to defend Taipei so long as it is an independent country. We've just seen Pompeo walk away from that policy and basically say it's an independent country regardless of what Beijing wants, which is going to just cause more trouble with China. That's what you need to worry about. From now until January 20th, there's going to be mischief making at a minimum, and I fear worse than that. They are also trying to hobble the incoming administration. It isn't just that they're not providing the money that's required under the 1963 Presidential Transition Act. It is also that they're not, I am sure, assigning FBI agents and Office of Personnel Management agents to vet people for their security clearances, all of which will hobble the incoming administration.
To your point, David, this is a life or death situation because of COVID. I mean, Dr. Ashish Jha says if the Trump team were to work with the Biden team just on COVID, we could save tens of thousands of lives by January.
Indeed. And imagine what the vote count might be if the tripling of infection numbers that we've seen in the last couple of days since the voting ended had taken place, say, at the end of October. People are going to die. Lots of people have unnecessarily died already. We run something at DC Report called the Trump Pandemic Death Tracker, and we hold him accountable for all the deaths in the U.S. above the level we would have if we had followed the practices in South Korea, which had its first known case on the same day. If we had done that, we would have about 3,000 deaths, not close to a quarter of a million deaths. And that so many people did not hold Trump accountable for all of these deaths. More people than died, Americans died in World War I, Korea, Vietnam together, is an astonishing statement about the degree to which large numbers of Americans, particularly people in the bottom 90%, are alienated from our government because it has not been meeting their needs. It's been hurting and damaging them for years, and which I wrote a best-selling trilogy of books explaining earlier in this century.
CNN reported yesterday that 200,000 more lives could be lost in the next few months. Doctors say these are lives that do not have to be lost, to your point, David. And what we do today will determine who lives and dies this winter. You can find David and his team's reporting at yourcallradio.org. David K. Johnston is co-founder of dcreport.org. They report on not what politicians say, but what they actually do. Scott Horton is a legal and national security affairs writer for Harper's Papers magazine. Scott, what's your take on what's happening with these positions that have been replaced at the Pentagon and what Trump could be capable of doing in the next 2 months?
Well, I guess I'd start with the column that David Ignatius wrote in the Washington Post and what almost any senior White House advisor will say if you speak to them, and that is that this has to do with a struggle to declassify certain documents, which will show definitively that Trump never colluded with the Russians. I have to say, I think that's hogwash because, of course, Trump is himself at the apex of the entire classification system. So he could, with the stroke of a pen, declassify and release all those things. There's no need to appoint all these people. Rather, I think David is right. I mean, my bigger concern is the destruction of documents and records from the last 4 years and the positions to which these people have been appointed. Definitely, they're all in a position as guardian and custodians of records, particularly highly classified records. So I think that's a big concern. And then we have to be concerned also about initiatives that Trump had at one point to deploy troops to the streets in the United States. We know back on June 1, he attempted to do this. He pressed it. He had a meeting of his cabinet with the Joint Chiefs and with the Secretary of Defense. And we know that they felt later that they got roped into something that they didn't entirely understand. And the Pentagon pulled back. I mean, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense pulled back. This is wrong. We're not going to allow troops to be used this way. And that was the source of a major rupture between them and the White House and Trump personally. So I think that this move has to do with opening the door again for the domestic deployment of troops, or at least I think that's something we really do need to worry about.
So you think it's domestic? You don't think that he would take any international action, like any attacks?
I think international action is also a worrisome scenario. So, and particularly two things I would keep my eye on. One is Iran. And of course, we know that Pompeo is out there trying to stir up more trouble with Iran right now. He's getting a pretty insulting pushback from European leaders. I mean, Emmanuel Macron was just on French television saying that he's not interested in meeting with soon to be former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And if any meetings do occur with French officials, they'll only be in the presence of representatives of the incoming administration. And that to me suggests that he wants to raise issues surrounding Iran and possibly also Afghanistan with them that they don't want to engage with him on. And then the other really is the DPRK, is North Korea, which was a flashpoint at the beginning of the presidency, could be again at the end.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you both also about the legal issues facing Trump. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer recently ran a piece arguing that Trump is really afraid of ending up in jail. She writes, "No American president has ever been charged with a criminal offense, but as Trump fights to hold on to the White House, he and those around him know that if he loses, an outcome that nobody should count on, but he has lost," she wrote this before the election, "the presumption of immunity that attends the presidency will vanish. Given that more than a dozen investigations and civil suits involving Trump are underway, he could be looking at an endgame even more perilous than the one confronted by Nixon." And in this piece, Norm Ornstein, who is a big Trump critic, a Republican, said, quote, "The odds are 99.999% that New York state authorities will have him on all kinds of tax fraud. We know these aren't crimes that end up with just fines." David, you've reported on this for many, many years. What are your thoughts?
Well, Donald will be indicted by the Manhattan grand jury for bank, insurance, tax fraud. He will be tried. I anticipate even if they put him in one of the very red counties where I live in Western New York, he will be convicted. The New York State Attorney General has a civil case, which both John Moskow, the great prosecutor in the BCCI bank scandal, and I agree is likely to morph into a New York State racketeering charge. And the mere indictment for racketeering in New York State would allow prosecutors to seize Trump, what he owns of Trump power, Mar-a-Lago, his golf courses, his jet, any other fruits of a criminal enterprise. In addition, he's got roughly 30 suits brought by women alleging sexual assault. The most troubling one for Donald is E. Jean Carroll, the former Saturday Night Live writer and magazine writer. She kept the clothing she was wearing when she says he raped her at Bloomingdale's department store in a dressing room, and she is seeking a court order to get his DNA. Once Trump leaves the White House, his privileges and immunities end. And so I anticipate she will get his DNA, and if it's his DNA on her clothing, he's in a world of hurt in all the other sexual assault cases. Mm.
Wow. Scott, what would you add? Olivia Nuzzi has a piece in The Intelligencer. She spoke to a number of close people around Trump. One person who speaks to Trump often said, quote, "He's out of money. He worries about being arrested. He worries about being assassinated. It hasn't been a great experience for him. He likes showing people around the White House, but the actual day-to-day business of being president, it's been pretty unpleasant for him." I mean, so many people spoke off the record and just made some damning comments here.
I think that's right. I mean, I did up a list of 13 separate bombs waiting to go off the instant he loses immunity. I think David actually hit the ones at the top of the list. But, you know, you have this basic problem of the huge debt overhang, depending on how you calculated it's between $500 million and $1 billion that he owes, an awful lot of which is coming due very quickly. I mean, that's got to weigh on him very heavily. And that may, in fact, be driving him to do some of the very strange things he's doing right now, the grifting he's doing with his own supporters. But then I would add very quickly the Michael Cohen case. Remember, he is individual number one, the unindicted co-conspirator of that case. And we know from the sentencing memorandum that they believe all the facts are in place to charge him as long as he loses immunity. So a new U.S. attorney in the Southern District, or even potentially the current one, Audrey Strauss, might opt to bring those charges. Second, we have the Hawke Bank matter. We have a huge disclosure from the New York Times suggesting his direct engagement in the standing down of that major criminal case and doing it for no reason, for no gain for the United States, with a number of people suggesting he may have gotten personal benefit from it. So that's a huge matter which may open as well. And then just looking in the Scottish newspapers today, you know, I see in Scotland a demand for a an unexplained wealth order surrounding Turnberry, as local authorities in Scotland have looked over the New York Times disclosures about his tax returns and see no accounting there of how he came up with the money to acquire Turnberry, to maintain it, and to expand it. I mean, we're talking in this case about hundreds of millions of dollars, certainly at least $200 million. I think he may be facing demands there as well.
Well, let's quickly hear from a caller. Let's go to Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I don't know how to state this, but sort of ramble around it. This is an existential threat. I've been listening to Gelb, I think the man's name is, either at the Atlantic, I think he's at the Atlantic, and Trump is setting up martial law. He's testing it in different places. Who's funding him? I mean, it's probably Russia, Putin, but he's going to pull a lever, get all these Republican legislatures in various states, like Michigan, where I used to be from, and they'll just pull a coup. This is a coup. Aren't people really upset? You know, the people listening to this show, and perhaps myself, are effete liberal, you know, progressive Democrats. Is anybody reacting to this guy? This is a very scary situation. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you. David, what are your thoughts on this? And really, how concerned should people be?
Well, I think Scott hit it exactly right, that the margin of 5 million votes makes this almost impossible to pull off. Bart Gellman, who wrote the article, is a very good reporter, but a number of legal scholars, I teach law, but I'm not a legal scholar, have criticized the piece for not being well-grounded, and so have political science professors. But there's no question that if Donald could find a way to hang on to power, he would do so. He doesn't enjoy the support of our military leadership, our officer corps, who only take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not to support the president. And so that's not going to do him any good. But he's going to cause a lot of damage between now and then and do everything he can to make the next administration appear to be illegitimate. And there will be more trouble as we go forward with Mitch McConnell for the same reasons, unless the highly unlikely result occurs in Georgia and the Democrats win both of those seats.
James writes, if Trump resigns, could Pence pardon him if he hasn't yet been charged with crimes?
If he does, he could pardon him. Here's the problem for Pence. Doing an official act for anything of value is bribery and a crime. And being president of the United States, even if it's for 1 hour, is something of value. So Mike Pence's lawyers would undoubtedly tell him, are you nuts? You could go to prison. Mm.
And Scott, we also have to keep in mind that this would not cover state crimes, which we've discussed right earlier. So that would only be effective with respect to federal crimes.
And Scott, we have about a minute left. How concerned should people be about all of this?
Well, I'll tell you the most reassuring thing. I mean, particularly when we look at the 7 days in May type issues and the mobilization of the military on our streets. I mean, I think it's quite clear that Trump and many of his advisors have thought about that, factored that into their plans. There are some remarkable things that have happened in the Pentagon, and that's particularly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff 2 days ago giving a really quite remarkable speech in which he says, you know, our service members take an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And that is how we're different from the military of a developing nation will countenance or become involved in a coup d'etat. And a lot of people heard these remarks and sort of stepped back and saying, why is he giving this speech? And I think this is a speech that was given with an audience of one, which is Donald Trump. He was saying, no, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole. Sorry.
Scott Horton is legal and national security affairs writer for Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. David K. Johnston is co-founder of DCReport.org and author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David and Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. And we will definitely continue to cover this angle. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.